This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you'd like to talk with Zorba, give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some interesting research and topics.
Yes, we're going to talk about aging and how people who are not socially active begin to lose muscle mass.
Whoa.
Right. It's not just getting on the treadmill. It's going out with friends and family. We'll talk about how important that is. And we're going to talk about banking your ovaries. If you're a young woman, you don't want to have kids now, but you know you're going to want to have them later. Can you put them in an ovary bank and then reproduce at an a later age?
Banking your ovaries.
Banking your ovaries.
We have a recipe from the vault.
That's right. Potato pizza. It may sound strange. It is strange, but boy, is it good. If you love potatoes, if you love pizza, this one's for you.
This is from the vault. I didn't try it after the last time we did it. And I ain't going to try it now. Potato pizza. 800-462-7413. Here's a listener, Zorba in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Zorba.
How can we help?
I have two boys who are both into youth baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, they both seem to throw the ball harder than other kids their age, which gets them a lot of attention, which they seem to really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
My question really centers around the pain that can follow pitching, and what of that is potentially just, you know, workout soreness and muscle pain, and what is joint pain, and how you could tell the difference, and what level of concern I should have around those.
Interesting questions. Let me ask you, have you clocked them?
I have.
How fast do they throw?
The 11-year-old can throw 55, and the 13-year-old can throw 65, almost 70.
Boy, that's good for those ages, isn't
it? Wow, that's pretty incredible. That's pretty incredible.
The really good pitchers in the majors throw in the 90s.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
This is really good.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So have they had pain from tossing?
Interestingly enough, the younger one gets weakness after pitching, but not a lot of pain. But my 13-year-old, who's also growing, he's in a really significant growth phase, also has the most pain. He can actually be unable to throw for several days after a weekend tournament.
You bring up some interesting points. You know, first of all, you've got kids who obviously are athletic and they love doing what they're doing. They get lots of kudos because they're doing so well, and that is really neat. And then the issue has to do with whether or not there's actually damage that's done. That's kind of the bottom line issue. And this goes along with the issues that actually concern girls more than boys, and it concerns soccer and girls and knee injuries and how women are built versus how men are built. And girls, often when they engage in similar activities in competitive soccer, tend to have more knee injuries than boys, and this has to do with how much your muscle mass is doing, how much stress, if it will, is doing to your joints. And it's the same thing with your sons. You know, obviously, first of all, they've got that motor memory, that fast twitch. They're good at pitching, and they're using their muscles to the maximal amount, and they may be, and it's clearly putting some stress on their joints. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they've got pain afterwards. It's joint pain, and it's ligamentous pain. And the issue is, what do we do about it? So what have you done so far? Have you given them ibuprofen or Aleve? That's step number one. What have you done when they get the pain?
Both of those things. So we've used both ibuprofen and Aleve.
Mm-hmm. Do you use it before the game?
He will. The oldest will actually take it during the game and then again after.
What I would recommend is step number one, because it may be useful, is get Aleve. Aleve is great. How much do they weigh, roughly?
I don't know exactly. I would guess right around 140, 150.
Okay, somewhere in that range. So it's two Aleve tablets every 12 hours, and I would take it before the game, at least an hour before the game, because it'll be in their system before they start pitching. And so the anti-inflammatory effect of the drug is going to be on board before they start. And sometimes that alone relieves a lot of the pain, because there's just less inflammation. And you give it every 12 hours around the clock if they're going to be in a tournament. That's number one. Number two, the right stretching exercises. Do they stretch out before they play?
They do, although I'm not sure that we're very school than proper stretching.
That's number two, and that's what you need. And I don't recommend you go to a website. I often put stretching exercises on our website, but I recommend that you get a trainer or a physical therapist to show them the right way to stretch out. Because often if you stretch out before a game, your muscles will be warmed up, if you will. They'll be lubricated. That's not exactly what happens, but that's approximately what happens. And the ligaments will be better able to take that. And then they want to stretch out during the game. In other words, you don't just stretch out once. You have to use it for an hour or two. You know, if you're in a break time, you stretch out again, because again, that stretching out, relax, you know, the ligaments are tightening up when they're pulling on the joint. You want to stretch them out to get them to relax. And then the final thing is look at how many innings produces the pain. In other words, if it continues despite the fact that they're stretching and doing the leave, then you may want to limit how much they do in the game. Remember, it's a game, right?
Right.
And that's important. You don't want to give any permanent injury for this. They're growing boys. And so the limitation may be how much they actually do. But I would do the stretching properly taught. I would do the anti-inflammatory on a regular basis beforehand. And then I would clock in how much activity that is. And if that's the case, then the coaches may say, hey, look, he can do this amount, but he can't do other, you know, that amount. In which case, believe me, the other kids get a chance. And when they go up and they do their pitching, they still get their kudos.
Interesting stuff. Can your kids throw the curve?
Not yet.
That's yet to come.
Thank you so much for your call. Good luck with your boys and congratulations.
Thank you.
Yep. 800-462-7413.
You know, I think the bottom line in situations like this is you want to reward your children. You want to make sure that they do well. They're getting kudos to their athletic kids. They've got a dream they're going to be in the majors. Maybe they will, although the chances that they'll go to medical school and become a neurosurgeon are greater than the chances they'll get into the major leagues. I mean, that's the reality of how unusual it is. But you want to make sure that you don't cause injury. And the way you do that is by looking properly at how much they can do, giving their bodies the best thing they can possibly do, and then sometimes limiting their activities. Mm-hmm. And that's your job as a parent. Your job is to encourage them, but if they're going to injure their bodies, to limit them.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, this is interesting to me. Social activity can actually make us healthier, our body healthier?
Absolutely. And this is part of a longitudinal study, and we've discussed this study before. It comes out of Rush Medical Center in Chicago, and they've been following, I think it's now for almost 10 years, senior citizens who were healthy. They were seniors, they were 65 or older, and they're following them over time to see what makes them healthier and keeps them healthier and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. And this particular program years ago showed that health literacy was very important. People who kept abreast of their health and understood what they were doing actually lived longer. And this particular study now is looking at social activities. And social activities were defined as going out to movies, being with your friends, being with your family. Believe it or not, going to Indian casinos, that's what I call a social activity, but being with other folks. And they looked at social activities as a separate factor on aging and how it encouraged good muscle mass. They took out those people who exercised, and they said, let's take exercise and control it. Mm-hmm. So half the people exercised, but they weren't socially active. And some of the people didn't exercise and they were socially active. And they looked over time to see what happens. Social activity increases muscle mass, regardless of whether or not you hit the gym or not.
How do you explain that?
Well, first of all, I don't really have a complete explanation for this, but we know that social activity is important to keep your brain active. We've known for years that social activity, just from a death point of view, people are socially active tend to live longer than people who are not socially active. We know that people are socially active are less disabled. People who are, for instance, in their 40s and 50s and have strong social relationships, if they get an injury, they get back on their job. So we know that it affects our brain, but it clearly now affects our muscle mass. Maybe it just makes us move spontaneously throughout the day. You know, if you're not socially active, maybe you're a slug.
You're sitting watching television.
And nothing else.
Yeah.
You don't get up. Maybe you get up and you feed yourself and then you sit down. You're not physically, just the simple activity of physically getting out of your house and being with other people may produce more spontaneous activity. For instance, we know people who jiggle more in their chairs like I do. I'm always moving around.
I do that too, tend
to be thinner than people who don't have spontaneous activity. We know that people who move around more burn about 300 more calories a day than people who are just slugs. Well, maybe it's that moving around and being with other people that simply fires those muscles and make them. But I don't think we have to know why. I think we have to know is. In other words, if you are socially active, you maintain muscle mass. So what does this mean? Well, this means part of your plan as a growing and aging adult means engaging in social activities with people you like. And it means that as you get older, because people fall away from you, they die. My neighbor died, you know, a little while ago, you know, just a couple of months ago. And he always came over to my house during the summer. We would jump in the pool. And now he doesn't jump in the pool with me. Well, I don't go in the pool as much. I've got a pool in my house. Well, right. I've got to replenish that with somebody else who I'm going to be socially active with, because I don't like to jump in the pool alone. It's not as much fun. And as you get older, you tend not to replenish those people in your life. And that may be important to keep your body up to date from a muscular point of view.
That's really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Callers waiting, and right now an open line for you. As we move along, Zorba, to a listener in Seymour, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, my question has to do with... During the last year, I successfully lost 40 pounds and then went through a whole lot of stress. Didn't change radically my eating. You know, I'll admit to a couple of sweets here and there. But I gained back quite a bit of weight. And I want to know how to combat stress-related weight gain.
Sure, sure. First of all, congratulations on losing that 40 pounds, even though you've gained some back. How'd you do it?
I actually went, can I say the name of the program?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Weight Watchers.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Weight Watchers is great. I happen to love Weight Watchers. It's a good program. Well-balanced, good meals, great plan. I think the social aspect of Weight Watchers is really important. We just talked about muscle mass mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. social mass as you get older. Being with other people and doing it as a group is great. I think it's a great program. I send people there all the time. What produced the weight gain? Did you then continue with Weight Watchers or did you stop it?
A little lax, and yeah. I will own on that. But the other thing is, of course, I was just how could I say it? More stressed than usual, more hypervigilant, certainly mm-hmm. greater, startled more easily, all that good stuff. So I know that I was having more adrenaline.
Yeah, of course. These can be very tough times, and in this time of financial stress, it's very tough times. One way I think of combating the stress-related weight gain and the lack of exercise is through developing a schedule that you simply pay attention to. Now, you think about Weight Watchers, what do? You go in there once a week. You weigh in, you go through a certain process. There's the regularity of the schedule that helps keep you regular. And there's something about regularity of a schedule that also can reduce issues of trauma, of stress, of hypervigilance that you said that almost sound like mm-hmm. a PTSD, you know, that are related mm-hmm. to post-traumatic stress disorder. So I recommend that you write yourself a written plan. That you sit down and you say, what am I going to do this week to develop my weight loss program? What am I going to do? How many calories? Because with Weight Watchers, you know how to count. You don't count calories, but you count, you know, whatever their present discussion in.
Points,
it's the points. Yeah. That's right. So you count your points. You say, what am I going to do with my points? What am I going to do for my mental health this week? Once a week, you know, are you going to go to a meditation class or yoga? Are you going to go to a counselor? What am I going to do for that? And what am I going to do physically with my body to reduce the stress? What sort of exercise program am I going to do? It's not just points. It's also mental stress and it's also physical exercise. And you have to develop the individual plan for you. Mm-hmm. That's what you need to do. And you can do this, but you've got to be a little bit more vigilant. And just looking at your plan for the week sometimes can say, hey, I didn't do it on Wednesday. I failed. I'm going to do it on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. for all of us, it's very tough. Some of us can write a plan and stick to us, but 98% of us can't. You know, we do it for a week or two, And then we fail. And believe me, I'm one of them. I exercise with a trainer one day a week. And 2 days ago, I said, I don't feel like exercising. And I thought, well, I'm going to feel guilty if I don't do this at least once during the time. But I've got to do it twice. And so I looked at it and I said, I developed a plan. I've got to stick to it. And I fit it in even though I didn't want to.
I didn't want to.
So you've got to develop your plan for the weight points from a point of view, Weight Watchers, the psychological issues and the physical issues. And that's the way that you will reduce the stress in your life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you for the call at 800-462-7413.
You know, the issue of stress cannot be underplayed. It always plays a role. And for some of us, we bounce back quicker from stress. And for others, it just kind of lingers. And when you mix it in with these financial times, you know, when you've got stress on one hand and you're paying the bills on the other hand, your body can just go to pot. I mean, it could just go to seed. And sometimes just developing a plan can help you feel better. And when you feel better, you can handle the stress better.
Well, we go from a caller, Zorba, in Seymour, Tennessee, to a listener in Seymour, Wisconsin.
Seymour to Seymour.
Yeah. Hi.
Well, hello.
What's up?
Ah, nothing much. I got stung by a bee a couple of weeks ago, and it got me thinking, because I had recently heard there's a new type of therapy out there, and I'm not talking about like honey or, you know, bee pollen or all sorts of other fancy things like that. I'm talking about people actually taking a bee in a pair of forceps, putting it on your skin until it stings you. And I was wondering, because after I got stung by that bee, I said, no.
You're not going to have this done. Yeah. You're not going to sting a bee for you. Well, I'll give you an interesting anecdote. Here's my question for you. How many people do you think die of venomous snakes every year, snake bites in America? How many people die of venomous snake bites?
Well, I kind of already know the statistic is way less than bee stings.
That's right. Yeah. It turns out, it's exactly right. It turns out that about four to five people die every year in America, at most, sometimes it's two, of snake bites, and 250 to 500 people die of venomous insect bites, be it bee stings or others. So it's a very, very dangerous thing to deal with. And the more you're stung, the more likely you are to develop an allergy to bee stings.
Well, what about his question on the medical benefits of a bee sting?
A stupid, dumb, dangerous therapy. That's what I think. I think it's stupid, dumb, and dangerous. First of all, there's no scientific evidence anywhere that by putting venom on your skin, which is what you're doing with that, that it's going to produce anything. Second of all, we know it's a leading venomous bite in America, our bee stings. It would be like, this is equivalent to, well, I think I'll get a rattlesnake and have it bite my skin, and then I'll see whether or not my arthritis is better. Duh. You'll be dumb. You know, you might die from that, and then your arthritis is better because you're dead. And there's no evidence that it does any good at all. And this is a good example of some of the alternative medicine therapies that people do that are highly dangerous, that they think because it's, quote, natural, because you're using something that works with bees, that you'll get something. And just because it's natural doesn't mean it's safe.
Now, this was 2 weeks ago. Are you okay now from the bee sting?
Oh, I've been stung by every manner of stinging creature.
Oh, hey,
I actually have an appointment with the rattlesnake guy in about a half an hour.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, made our day. Before the break, Zorba, let's go to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out Mary Ann from Boise, Idaho, who has a stump the doc question for you. Mary Ann writes, I frequently swallow the wrong way. My second husband thought this was very odd. He then met my son, and my son also swallows the wrong way. My sister does this, as does her daughter and granddaughter. Is this a medical condition? Have you ever heard of it before? My sister and I have commented that we need to think before swallowing. I don't believe this is true for everyone. Is it? Or are we just weird?
They're weird. That's what they are. They're just weird. Now, First of all, I assume swallowing the wrong way means they swallow and then they choke.
I didn't know. Yeah. I think that
maybe
it just means you can't swallow without thinking.
Yeah,
first.
You do swallow without thinking because we swallow all the time. But I assume swallowing the wrong way, she means that she's choking. I don't know for sure, but let's assume that.
Yeah.
Let's make that as our assumption that it gets there. And she has to think about it because they keep on coughing or it comes up. There are a couple of things that get involved. First of all, when you're older, you may swallow, quote, the wrong way because you have a decreased motility in your esophagus. In other words, there are medical problems that can produce this when you're older. Also, if you've had a stroke, you can also have the same problem with that. When you're younger, it may be some kind of learned activity. In fact, learned activity is you start to talk, and you're starting to talk while you're swallowing and breathing. So if you stop talking when you're drinking, you may swallow the right way. And that's probably the most common learned activity that people have when they're doing it. Or they may not be sitting up when they swallow. But are they weird? You betcha.
if you do another bodily function wrong, or if you...
bodily function. We're going to get lots of emails on this. If you do another bodily function wrong, send in an email to zorba@wpr.org. I love it.
We have lots more calls. Maybe a call from you at 800-462-7413 coming up. We have our recipe, which is next. Don't forget the medical myth buster late in the hour. All here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. And it's recipe time now, Zorba. We're once again digging into our vault for our recipe of the week. Not too long ago, you suggested we give an encore performance to an old fan favorite, potato pizza. This is your fault that we're doing.
I'm looking at you.
This one.
And I'm looking at your face thinking, this is something that doesn't connect with you.
This one was popular enough to make our cookbook many years ago, but in case you don't own that cookbook, in which case, what are you waiting for? Here it is one more time, the recipe for potato pizza.
Now I know in your brain, you're thinking potatoes and pizza, they just don't go together.
Why would I think that in my brain for the recipe called potato pizza?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Now, do you like potatoes?
Yes.
Yes. Do you like pizza?
With sausage, green pepper. Yes.
You see, but you're just thinking now. You're not thinking outside of the box. You're thinking in the box. What did I have when I was a kid? I had sausage and green pepper pizza. You know, there are a variety of other pizzas that people eat. Some people eat like exotic pizzas, like taco pizza, and they have pizza with like not just mushrooms. They might use other things such as, you know, making
pineapple. This is so good that if I call the pizza place and say, deliver me a potato pizza,
what's
going to happen?
They're going to say next.
Okay.
But it is very good.
Okay.
So let's go through the recipe. This recipe came from an old friend of mine, Nancy Ross Ryan. She is a cookbook editor par excellence, worked for a variety of magazines. She developed this for our shows and a show a number of years ago, and it's really dynamite. So first of all, you have to start out with some pizza dough. The way that I tend to make dough, you can find a variety of very simple recipes for pizza dough. If you've got a bread machine, you simply put the stuff in, put it on dough, and it makes it for you. Mm. And you can also get it in mixes. Jiffy Pizza Dough Mix, which is a very cheap, inexpensive, comes in a box. You know when you go down the aisle, you see the Jiffy boxes?
Yeah.
It's right next to the Bisquick. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Very cheap, inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You put it in, you add water, and you're done.
Okay.
And this particular recipe I use with my kids at home all the time because it was very simple to do. So, number one, you have to start out with the pizza dough, whatever way you're going to make it.
Right.
Take it from a box. Mm-hmm. Simple, easy. Vegetable cooking oil spray.
vegetable oil cooking spray.
Yeah, what we're going to use, like the PAM spray or the other sprays, because this is a way that you don't have to use much oil to basically make things and lubricate them.
Okay.
1 tablespoonful of cornmeal.
A big tea cornmeal.
And a pound of potatoes. So a red potato scrubbed and unpeeled, great way to do it. Yukon Gold potatoes would be good. For this particular recipe, you could use Idaho potatoes, whatever potato you want to use, whatever your favorite potato is.
I love those red potatoes.
I happen to like reds, too. Yeah, so small reds are what I tend to use.
A pound of them.
That's right. Small reds. They're my favorite. Mm-hmm. A half pound of yellow onions, paired, sliced paper thin. They can be red onions also, which would make it look prettier.
Oh, yeah. Half a pound of onions, paired, sliced paper thin.
That's right. One clove of garlic, finely minced.
A clove of garlic, finely minced.
And now a half teaspoon of ground pepper, salt, and fresh sage leaves, minced. You could use other things for the sage instead, and we'll talk about that.
Half a little tea. Fresh sage leaves, minced, ground black pepper, and salt.
That's right. Now, you can really use any green herb that you want to use, or I'll say at the Australian rate, herb instead of herb. But you can use any green herb that you want to use. They Aussies call them herbs, not herbs. You could use thyme. You could use basil. You could use sage. You could use parsley. But make it fresh. That's the most important thing. Okay. So here's how we do it. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Roll out the pizza dough on a floured work surface to fit a 12-inch round pizza pan. Okay, and once again, you've made the dough either from a box or personally. Spray the pan lightly with cooking spray. Fit the pizza dough on the pan and dust it with cornmeal on the top. Okay, you're dusting it with cornmeal. Now, dry the potatoes thoroughly. So you've sliced them, but you want them to be dry. Mm. And then slice them as thin as possible into rounds. Again, I tend to dry them again if they're really moist on the inside.
Why do you have to do that?
Because they'll have a little more crunch to them. They'll have a little more texture to them.
Okay.
If they're too wet, they'll be mushy. And mushy is okay when you make something that's mashed, but you don't want that on a pizza. You want a little texture bite, and that's why you're drying them. Place the potatoes thinly and the thinly sliced onions, the minced garlic, and the sage in a bowl and toss it. So you've got the potatoes. When they're drier, they're going to pick up the moisture. The lack of moisture, rather, is going to allow them to pick up the green herb that you're using. Then toss it with a rubber spatula, mix it well, spray the pizza dough with cooking spray. Okay, so now you've got a thin layer of oil, cooking spray on there. Layer the potato on mixture evenly across, sprinkle with salt and pepper. Bake it for 30 to 40 minutes, not for 5 or 10 minutes. It's not a frozen pizza.
Right.
We're heating it up. It's 30 to 40 minutes at 400 degrees until the potatoes are cooked and golden brown. Mm-hmm. Remove it from the oven, let it rest for a minute or two, and slice.
Actually, this time around, this sounds kind of
You're good. Shocked, aren't you? You can now see how this is something that's good.
Could I throw a few sausages and pepperoni on top of this?
You actually could. You could throw some sausage.
But it wouldn't be hard healthy anymore.
It wouldn't be heart healthy. But for you, Tom, we'll make an exception for you. So looking at it from a caloric point of view, 317 calories, very little from fat, of course. Most of the calories are coming from potatoes. If we look at it from a cholesterol point of view, it's very, very low cholesterol. But it's a wonderful, wonderful way to sort of serve potatoes in your diet in a heart healthy way. We love potatoes, but in our society, most of the potatoes we eat are fried. They're French fried potatoes.
Yeah.
This will have the texture of a fried potato without the oil. Try it. You'll like it.
And again, if there's a recipe you remember but can't find it, or if there's one you feel deserves an encore performance, let us know what it is. And it might end up being our next recipe from the vault. Just send the name of the recipe in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor recipes. And you can sign up for my tweet. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Let's see if we can help a listener now, Zorba, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling today to find out about corn allergies. So quite a while ago, I was eating a burrito that was separated, the tortilla shells were separated by cornstarch, and when a little bit of the cornstarch hit my face, I kind of swelled up like a balloon. I've been trying to contact doctors and get in, and haven't actually been able to find a doctor that can test for corn food allergies. It seems that every time I eat corn, which is in everything, I tend to have some, well, we'll call it stomach upset.
Oh, yeah, okay. Now, this happens with corn on the cob, too?
Corn on the cob, sodas that contain corn syrup, foods that contain small amounts of cornstarch. I've pretty much narrowed it down to corn.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And as you've known, corn isn't everything. Corn and peanuts are basically used for processed foods all over the place. I'm sure that's what you've noticed, right? Yeah, they're used because they're cheap, they're inexpensive, and a lot of companies produce a lot of corn, and that's basically what it is. The issue may be dose-related. First of all, let's assume you have a corn allergy. We can't really test for it. There are no antibodies for it. You'll find people who are called ecological physicians who will say they can do patch tests and other things. It's baloney. There's really no test for it. What you have to find out is how much corn can you eat without producing the problem. Now, first of all, you can't have high fructose corn syrup. Well, none of us should have it anyway. It's not good for us. There's some people who think that the present obesity epidemic is from high fructose corn syrup. We don't need it. We take too many calories in our society. Cut it out. No problem. No problem. Now, the other issues are in processed foods. And what you want to find out is it may be dose related. So it might be, for instance, you can't have corn on the cob, but you can eat some processed foods that have corn within them. And you just have to sift and winnow. You have to find out what foods you can tolerate and what foods you can't. Now, if it's a true allergy, antihistamines such as over-the-counter Claritin or Benadryl may help you, but it's usually an intolerance. It's usually not a true allergy. People usually don't break out with hives with it. It's not deadly. But basically, you have to find out what foods you can tolerate and what foods you can't, and you have to stay away from them. That's the only treatment. You're one of these people who, when you go out to a restaurant, it's more difficult because you have to find out what restaurants you can go to. They won't be able to tell you if there's corn in their cooking because they may use syrups and other, texturizers in the food that they have, even if they're natural products, and they're not going to look at the label and tell you there's no corn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I follow you. I actually found that antihistamines do work when I come in contact with corn starch.
Okay.
When I first noticed it, I was eating a burrito, and the little bit of corn starch that they apply to separate them so the shells don't stick together, a little bit of that got on my lip, and my lip swelled up to the size of my thumb.
Right, which makes it awful. So you may have, you've got an intolerance and you may have a bit of an allergy component. It swells up to your, it's a big lip, it's not good. I've got a question for you. Do you like to cook?
Oh, I love to cook.
You love to good cook. So your answer to going out with people is to cook for them because then you have control and minimize your restaurants. And that's the advice I would give you.
Thank you. Yeah. Sounds good.
Thank you so much for the call, and Zorba and I will be over at your place someday.
Not for corn on the cob.
For a cornless meal. Now, Zorba, let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out a listener named Bill. Bill is 50 and does lots of exercising. He writes, I'm always looking for better ways to keep and restore energy using natural foods. I prefer plants to animals. I've heard that sweet potatoes are one of the best foods you can eat both before exercising for energy and after for recovery. I also heard results of a study last year stating that chocolate milk is a great recovery drink. Can you clarify these two items for me, please?
I love chocolate milk. Don't you love chocolate milk?
I hardly ever have it.
I love chocolate milk. I don't usually get it because it's higher in calories, but it reminds me of kindergarten when you serve chocolate milk. It makes me feel good.
Yeah.
Well, if it makes you feel good, it's good for recovery.
Sure.
Now, is it a special thing? No, chocolate milk just has more carbohydrates and more sugar than milk, but it sure tastes good.
Yeah.
So if that makes your recovery good and you feel better, like you're going for it, fine, but it's psychological.
What about sweet potatoes?
Psychological. Sweet potatoes are great. They're a carbohydrate. They're sweet. They were much more common than potatoes in revolutionary times. We have more sweet potatoes than regular potatoes. I'm sure that's more than you want to know about sweet potatoes, because when I talk about that every time, your eyes roll, and it's more than anyone wants to know. But are sweet potatoes good for recovery? Yes, they're good for recovery, just like pasta is often good for recovery because soccer players love pasta. They have pasta meals to help them with recovery. And you want to know why? Because if you gave them sweet potato meals for their recovery, they would never eat it. Teenage boys and girls do not eat sweet potatoes. Right. Good for recovery because it's a carbohydrate, yeah, and it will give you some sugar, which will replenish basically the glycogen in your liver. Mm-hmm. They're a great recovery food, one of many.
He asks about sweet potatoes also before you exercise.
Sure, because it's just like carbohydrate loading that a lot of young boys and young women do before they go and they play soccer or football or before they go and play Little League. Absolutely. Carbohydrate loading gives you more glycogen in your liver, and that's what you need for fast energy, so go for it.
Mm-hmm. And when you have enough energy, send in your lifestyle questions to the show. Just send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our medical myth buster coming up a little later. Before that, some really interesting research to talk about and more of your calls here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Glad to have you along this time. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number if you have a question for Zorba. But right now, Zorba, I feel like I'm somewhere in the distant future. Banking ovaries?
Banking ovaries. Well, the initial technique came out with women who are getting chemotherapy. So when you get chemotherapy, often you destroy the ovaries. It's just one of the side effects of chemo. So they had their ovaries removed, had the chemotherapy for cancer, mm-hmm, and then after the cancer was cured or in remission, had the ovaries replaced in their body. And it's not that easy to replace ovaries, reattach, yeah, a blood supply. Yeah. And so there was a very high failure rate initially. And lo and behold, in some women, the ovaries took and they were able to conceive.
And now they're thinking about doing this or are doing this with younger women who want to preserve their ovaries to have children later in life?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. What they do with the ovaries is they bank them and they freeze them. Yeah. And a lot of the ovaries were simply destroyed by the freezing. But they developed a new technique of freezing them, which basically allows the eggs. They're not really the eggs, but they're the egg cells to remain intact. You don't produce the egg until you ovulate, but mm-hmm, the egg cells remained intact. So they've discovered that. And then they said, well, maybe we can do this in women who want to have children later. So here you are, you're in your early 30s and you're not in a relationship, and so you want to take your ovaries and have one or both of those ovaries removed and banked so you can have children when you're 45.
Yeah. Well, is this actually going on or is this in the experimental stage?
It's in the experimental stage, but it brings up a lot of very interesting issues. First of all, we don't know when you're 45. We know that the incidence of Down syndrome is higher when you're 45. We've assumed for many years it's because, quote, the eggs are old. Well, the eggs, and they're not really the eggs, they're the precursor eggs. Well, mm-hmm, the cells are still getting older when they're frozen. They're not frozen in time. They're simply frozen in the freezer. So they may still get old, and you may still have a higher incidence of Down syndrome. We don't really know.
Or maybe not.
Or we may have a higher incidence of babies who have deformities or other problems, other major medical problems. I mean, you are sort of interfering with Mother Nature,
yeah,
and freezing the ovaries. Now, if you have cancer and you're having chemotherapy, that's a different issue.
Sure.
And those women often then go off and have a baby, but we don't have enough evidence that these babies will be healthy. I think this is really a dangerous technique that may produce some major problematic outcomes.
Again, with all the ethical issues here, are they doing this now?
Well, the French have done this, and they banked it. But, of course, they haven't kept the ovaries in space for 15 years in the freezer because they haven't done it that long to be able to see what the results are. But I think it's very interesting. I think one of the issues is children often delay their childbirth, or moms delay their childbirth until they're older, potential moms. And the issue is, if you want to have a baby, do it when you're younger.
1-800-462-7413. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a friend who has developed a metallic taste in her mouth. She has stopped taking all of her medications, which weren't many. She took Lipitor and occasionally Ambien to sleep. She had her blood work tested. It came back perfect. She's stumped.
Hmm. How long has she had this?
Over a month.
Uh-huh. Now, what sort of non-pharmaceutical medications or remedies is she taking?
I don't believe any.
Mm-hmm. That may be it, though. Not believing may be it, but she may be taking it. The reason is all you have to do is look at the Zicam issue. Zicam was a cold remedy. The cold remedy came in a pill form. No evidence that it did anything to basically decrease the incidence of a cold. Homeopathic recipe, so it had the umbrella of safety, because in homeopathy, you have almost no medicine in there. It's hard to even, you can't even test for it. It's an extremely dilute solution. And then they developed Zicam in the nose, put it in the nose, and lo and behold, the FDA said stop using it because it decreases smell in at least 200 people don't have their sense of smell. You can get a metallic taste from anything that you take, be it over-the-counter remedies, be it nutraceuticals, be it other things that you take. So that's the first thing I'd ask.
How about prescription drugs?
Well, some prescription drugs can change taste. To my knowledge, Lipitor does not do it. To my knowledge, the drugs. What, she was taking Lipitor. What was the other drug she was taking?
Ambien on occasion to sleep.
Yeah, to my knowledge, that's not one of the known side effects. But I think stopping the drugs for a month are good. If it hasn't come back, then you've got to look for something else. Sinus problems, sinus remedies, polyps in the nose, growths within the sinus, fungal infections of the sinus, all of these can produce a change in taste. So does she have allergies?
No, she doesn't have allergies, but she does have a problem with her neck, and her physical therapist thought maybe something was pressing on some nerve center and causing this metallic taste in her mouth, but that seemed so far-fetched.
I think that's pretty far-fetched, but looking in the sinuses is not far-fetched at all.
Okay.
And I remember, now I have a question for you. Did you ever smoke?
No.
Okay, so I used to smoke years ago when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And when I was sick and had a cold, the smoke never tasted the same. I can remember I said, oh, I don't like it. And people who naturally are ill and sick don't smoke as much because it doesn't taste right. So anything that causes swelling in the nose or the sinuses can change your taste. I'd look for that. But before I look for that, ask her, are you taking any homeopathic remedies? Stop everything. Yeah. No supplements for 3 or 4 weeks.
We all lose taste as we get older.
Yes, we do.
Could this be, you know, could we ask, get a metallic taste?
Nah, not usually. And not a sudden. The taste that you lose, the sense of taste, which is really a sense of smell, occurs slowly over time. It's not a sudden thing. And it's usually not, quote, a metallic taste. A metallic taste usually means there's something going on.
Okay.
There's something that's happening. I look at the sinuses, look at allergies, no supplements, zero for a month and see what happens. Most of these things go away with time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for the call. Interesting. Let's get to our medical myth buster now, Zorba. Our myth today deals with children. You've heard the common phrase, did you have sugar for breakfast, when describing an overactive child before. But is there any link or truth between sugar and hyperactivity in kids?
Well, I love this question.
Yeah.
I love this myth.
And I know the answer, too, because we've talked about this on the program.
So what's the answer? Give us the answer.
There's no link.
The science says no link.
Yeah.
Okay. Science says there's absolutely no link between sugar and behavior. Now, I have 4 children. They're all older. Right. Right. When we had a sugar party, basically, you know, we have cake and ice cream and all that stuff. Yeah. We didn't call it a sugar party. Were they running around the house more? Absolutely.
Yeah, but it was a party.
There was no doubt about it.
It was a party.
It was a party. And it was sugar and we were all happy and we were having candy and other things. So from a science point of view, there's no link. And there have been a number of scientific studies that look at it. In fact, they've looked at sugar. They've looked at aspartame, which is NutraSweet. Mm-hmm. They've looked at Splenda and they have found no difference at all. Now, from a parental point of view, from a behavioral point of view, to me, the link is indisputable. Give your kids a lot of sugar and they run around the house. But I think it's because all the other activities that are associated with sugar.
Yeah.
And I think it may be the cues that we give socially to our children around it. Well, here's a lollipop. Here's some ice cream. Here's a popsicle. Don't eat too much of it because you'll be hyperactive. Yeah. So I think we give them verbal cues. And that link is indisputable because I know as a parent, when I gave them more sugar, they tend to do more. So the science says no. And the parent in me says yes.
And it's a kind of a good thing to have the wrong answer to this, because you tend to limit the sugar.
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong with limiting sugar. We have too much sugar in our society, too much high fructose corn syrup. We're addicting our children to the sweet tooth, and that's why we're fat. That's why we're fat. So stay away from sugar and you'll have a healthier child. But the science says no link.
And if you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-462-7413. And a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help you?
I'm having a strange phenomenon. When I eat a big meal or have a lot of drinks or just have a full stomach, my collarbone hurts.
Your collarbone hurts?
Yes. It's just the front part of the collarbone and just on the left side.
Uh-huh.
And it just is a constant aching feeling.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. How about your stomach?
My stomach is fine.
Your stomach feels fine. No pain at all. Do you have a lot of gas?
Full.
Do you have a lot of gas?
No.
Uh-huh. Just your collarbone, not your chest.
Just my collarbone, and it feels like it is the bone. I can, you know, I'll have a meal and I'll be rubbing my collarbone, and I'll get some strange looks from people.
Now, have you ever injured your collarbone?
I am an avid skateboarder and snowboarder, so I have lots of injuries, but you know, I've never broken my collarbone. I haven't had any major injury to that area.
So this happens no matter what the food is, every time you eat, certain times you eat. Give me a little bit more information.
I wish I was paying more attention to it, but it's usually, it doesn't matter the food. It is just if I've eaten a lot of anything.
See, the reason that I ask that is the diaphragm itself, one of the reasons that people have pain in their chest or in their arm is because the heart rests on the diaphragm, and the diaphragm has certain nerves, essentially, that then can produce a sensation in the left arm, in the chest, or down the arm. That's where the diaphragm is. And the stomach is on the other side of the diaphragm. And so, you know, in the belly part, in the abdomen, and when the stomach swells up or gets hot, some people can actually achieve pain and discomfort in their upper chest. They can say, my stomach is bloating, I've got some pain in my shoulder or my chest, and it's from their stomach. It can also be from their esophagus. When their esophagus, the lower part of the esophagus is innervated by the same sort of sensory fibers. And some people, when they get esophageal pain, when the esophagus is stuck, they actually get pain in their neck, and they'll actually get pain around their clavicle. That may be the pain you're experiencing. And in other words, and it may be related to certain foods. Alcohol, hot spicy foods, caffeine, and boarders often get a lot of caffeine. Caffeine can do it. And those are the issues that I would look at. So my suggestion is keep a diary. See what foods tend to do it or what time of the day is. When you have it, write down the time of the day, what the food is you have, and notice if you have a lot of gas or belching, because it's often, if it's a diaphragmatic thing that we're looking at, it'll be related to one of those three things. But if not, you've stumped the doctor. I have no idea what that is if that's not the case. But my guess is if it's something, it's from the diaphragm. So, but
I have had a splenectomy. Would that have something to do with it?
Absolutely. It may definitely be part of it, because you may have some scar tissue there in your spleen. When your stomach swells up, it may push on some nerves there. And because it pushes on some nerves, which are once again innervated in the same area, that may be part of it. So it might be scar tissue from the splenectomy for sure. Now, what'd you get the splenectomy for? Was this from a skateboard injury?
This was from snowboarding. I collided with a tree.
The tree attacked you and you had a spleen injury. So, you got to be careful. That's a serious injury. Was it an emergency surgery, sudden surgery?
It was very emergency surgery. I was life-flighted to the nearest hospital.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. But you didn't give up boarding or skating, right?
No, absolutely not.
Well, be careful. Don't go into those trees. Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate it. And before we leave for the week, Zorba, it's time to pay another fine to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police.
Great.
This citation comes from newly appointed Deputy Linda in Williamsville, New York. Quoting, "I love listening to the show. However, Whenever Zorba misuses words, he says, "Oh, that's a malaprop." So I guess I'm part of the grammar police now, because that is not a malaprop. That's just misusing a word. A malaprop is changing the first few letters of a word and still coming up with new words. Like if you wanted to say reading the book and you said beating the rook, that would be a malaprop.
Well, the malaprop came from Miss Malaprop. You know that, Tom, right?
No, I didn't.
Came from Miss Malaprop, which was, she was in a play, and the play was written by, if I remember correctly, I think it was Oscar Wilde, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was an Oscar Wilde play. And she kept malapropping. She kept on doing these changes of syllables and sentences and words. So often, if I mischange a word in a sentence, I often will use the word malaprop, which is probably an error, undoubtedly an error, if one is strict. But unfortunately, in the Midwest, often, we're kind of fuzzy when it comes to the misuse of the word. So I take that grammar police and I'll put my dollar in the box and say, you're right, I'm wrong, but I bet I'll continue to use it.
Now, here's what the dictionary says about what a malaprop is, according to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
A malaprop is...
By the way, Wikipedia is not a dictionary.
Yeah, right, I know.
So go ahead.
Malapropism is the substitution of an incorrect word for a word with a similar sound.
Right.
That's exactly a little different than what Linda said.
And it's from Oscar Wilde, and Miss Malaprop would say things like vice or rice.
Our producer, Adam Friedrich, who, as you know, knows all.
He knows all. He is the purveyor of all knowledge.
Well, not quite, because he says it wasn't Oscar Wilde, it was Richard someone. If Zorba's misspeech earns him a citation from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police, let us know by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And by the way, if I misspeak, that's okay to, you know, nail me too, by the way. See you next week, Zorba.
Take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call us day or night at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble, better known as Brad Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich, are sitting on the other side of the glass producing this hour. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting you to be around on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0718Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.